Hello, sword people. Welcome to the Sword Guy podcast. This is your host, Dr. Guy Windsor, consulting swordsman, teacher, and writer. Join me for interviews with historical fencing instructors and experts from a wide range of related disciplines as we discuss swords, history, training, and bringing the joy of historical martial arts into our modern lives. I'm here today with Bill Grandy, who is a longtime professional historical martial arts instructor and also a historical handcrafter, making beautiful scabbards and shields and things. I've seen his website is historicalhandcrafts.com. There'll be a link in the show notes. It's definitely worth a look. Now, without further ado, Bill, welcome to the show.
Hey, I am so happy to be here. If for no other reason than this pandemic's been long and it's nice to have a human to talk to that's besides my family.
Quite. Yeah. Actually, that's one of the really great side benefits of starting the podcast, which I hadn't really anticipated. It means regularly I get to sit down and chat about swords and other stuff with sometimes with old friends like you, but also sometimes with people who I've never met, which is like, it's a really good.
That's fantastic.
Very, very good for the old mental health. Okay. So whereabouts in the world are you?
So I'm in Virginia in the United States. I'm in the Northern Virginia area. Not too far from DC.
Okay.
Washington, DC, I should say, because I realized people outside of the US sometimes don't know what DC is.
Yeah, fair enough. Did you come along to Lord Baltimore's challenge in 2019?
I was there for the very first one, which I feel like was 2018, 2017,
right,
2018.
Okay.
I don't remember.
I know you're from Virginia and I was there for, strictly speaking, it's in Maryland, but. You know, it's that bit of the United States is basically all just suburbs of Washington, D.C.
So. Yes, you're exactly right. And so, yes, I was there for the very first one. I tied for winning the Lord Baltimore's Challenge with another gentleman. So, but the second one, unfortunately, I wasn't able to make it. So I understand you were at that one. I didn't know until afterwards.
Oh, you were not deliberately avoiding me then. Oh, good. That's good to know. because I think the last time I saw you then must have been at a WMAW or something like that.
Most likely.
So it's been a while.
It's been a number of years since I've seen you in person.
Well, we should fix that after the pandemic.
Yes, we should. I agree.
So what got you into historical martial arts in the first place?
So it's a long and winding story. I should start out by pointing out, so I technically have just retired from the Virginia Academy of Fencing, which is that's been my full-time career for the last 20 years. And so that was not an easy thing for me to retire from. There were some family health issues that I had to take care of, plus of just regular dad duty. So I'm for the first time in my entire adult life, I am not professionally teaching anymore. But I
think
started
you'll
out. I'm sorry. What was that?
Do you think you'll come back to it? Come back to teaching professionally?
I'll be honest. I don't know. Probably not professionally. I think that more than likely I will come back to it in some form, but something a lot less formal. Right now, I don't know what the future is for me as far as historical martial arts go, because with the pandemic going on, it's hard to say for sure. But I'm certain that once the pandemic lifts up and, you know, people can start meeting again, I will definitely be meeting with the various local, you know, fencing groups and HEMA groups and doing something. That right now is up in the air. And especially until my son gets a little older, I'm probably not going to do too much for at least another couple of years. So that's a very, very open field.
Yeah, sure. And that's actually like kicked me off into some other kind of questions I'm going to come back to later. But I interrupted you. So how did you get into all of this? What you started?
You could argue I started with The Princess Bride when I was a little kid. My first actual sword hobby was foil fencing, which I think I started around age 9, something like that. So that would be, for context, that's the late 80s for me.
Right.
did that for a very long time. I also did Aikido somewhere around age 11 or something like that throughout high school. So Aikido is not technically focused on swords, but it does have a sword component as well as a staff and a knife component. So it was something where I was at least learning how to move my body with an object like that. I know there's a lot of people who will jump on Aikido about that stuff, and some of it is true, but nonetheless, it still got me moving. It taught me mechanics. It taught me how I'm supposed to be turning my hips and turning my shoulders and so forth when I was swinging an object. So that was important for me. Mm-hmm. High school, I was doing stage combat, and that just put me in contact with people. Where high school is probably the first time I started learning that people were trying to recreate historical martial arts. Before then, I'd never heard of anyone doing it, and I was learning that through stage combat people. I was taking classes with Brad Waller, and he was doing stuff. And so that's how I started learning about it. And by the time I was in college, I was reaching out to people through, you know, like, for example, Sword Forum International, the old Hakka forums long before ARMA existed, where they used to be called Hakka. And that was the meeting ground for so many of the people who went on to start publishing and teaching. Sure. So I guess that's kind of where I officially got into the historical martial arts. And then around 1998, that's when I was still in college, mm-hmm. I started going to the Virginia Academy of Fencing. And that was very fateful because I would be there for a very long time. And I was just taking some foil classes there. There was a guy named Steve Atkison who had formed a historical swordsmanship program. A lot of people think I formed it at VAF, and I wasn't. Steve Atkison was the original guy. And that was 1998. So it was a very different world, right? Sure. There. He was teaching Talhofer, and that, over the years, you know, has become code for meaning you don't know what you're doing, right?
Yes, but pretty much.
But in his defense, it was 1998.
Sure. In 1998, we were all teaching some variation of Talhofer.
And he came from a stage combat background, and he really knew how to teach very well, and he knew how to teach stage combat very well. Mm-hmm. And what he did was, he was like, here's a fencing mask, here's a shinai, let's learn some stage combat moves and beat the crap out of each other. And it was glorious. I miss those days in some ways. It was so much fun. And eventually I start teaching at VAF, and I'm teaching beginning classes, and I'm teaching beginning classes for this historical program. And around that time is when I was really starting to read up more. And there wasn't a lot available back then, but I remember when Jörg Bellinghausen released his translation of Ringeck. And I was so excited because there were things in it that just were so mysterious, like throwing a zwerchow. I remember reading like, oh, you're supposed to put your thumb on the bottom of the sword and you're hitting with the short edge. That doesn't make any sense. What does this mean? And I remember it being just so exciting trying to figure these things out. Things that mm-hmm. nowadays, if you go to any events and you say a word like zwerchow, everyone goes, yeah, okay. Obvious. That's an easy one. Yeah. And back then it was just so mysterious. Yeah, so I just remember working through these things and going online, talking with everyone else. And back then I really wasn't even asking questions. I was just reading the things that people were saying. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I got my foot into it. And eventually I took over the program. Steve ended up leaving, and that's 20 years later.
Wow.
That's how I ended up doing what I did.
I think you're the only person I know who just got like basically offered a job teaching historical fencing. It's a really unusual career path. And so early. I mean, 2001, I started my own school in 2001. We had our 20th anniversary celebration literally this week. And and there you were, you know, teaching for a living historical martial arts at the same time. It's incredible.
Well, I say it that way, and it sounds very simple because it's just the easy way to say it. The truth is it's more involved, right? Everything is. Mm-hmm. When I first got hired, the owner, Alexander Rijic, he uh, he was a Russian fencing master. He came to the United States. You know, he grew up in communist Russia, where when he was 6 years old, he was brought to a fencing academy and told, this is what you're doing for your life, right? Yeah. He almost went to the Olympics, but then he defected to the United States. So he grew up in a very different world for fencing. And when he first was thinking about doing fencing in the United States, his wife was telling me the story about how at first he's like, no, I can't teach fencing. I can't teach fencing. And, you know, I would be bad at it. And then she convinced him to go and watch these fencing classes. And she described he was sitting in the bleachers all serious looking. And she's like, oh man, is he really intimidated by this? And she gets in the car and goes, so, you know what? I think that was okay. I mean, I think you could do that. And he goes, oh, I could do that. That was not fencing. I don't know what that was. That was not fencing. So he starts doing it and he scares all of his students away because he would scream at them. He would, and to be honest, he still teaches that way to this day, but he would scream at them and yell at them. And when they didn't do a move right, rather than telling them how to do it, he would just tell them how wrong it was. And so he couldn't keep any students. And that's when he realized he needs a different approach. So by the time I started there, he'd been running that for a while. And it was a good sized school by the time I arrived. I think he had something like 200 students by the time I arrived.
That's a big school.
Yeah, exactly. And part of that is how, when he realized he needed to get other coaches there who would be nice. And then of those people who said, no, I need to be yelled at, he would train them. Right. Okay. For some people that's work the thing. Well that way.
Coaching styles vary, you know, different students need different coaching styles. And right. While I'm not a fan of the yelling at them approach, there are some students who thrive in it.
I agree. He's trained champions.
Right.
I'm also not a yell at the student kind of person, which is why he hired me. When I'd been there for a number of years, he had watched me for a long time. He'd watch how I talk with newer students and all. And he just came up to me one day and said, like, yeah, I'd like you to start teaching some beginning classes. And what started to happen is more and more people stayed. Retention rate shot up through the roof. And after I'd been teaching just beginning classes for a year, he's like, no, I need you to do more. And when I was graduating college, that's when I was supposed to be looking for my so-called real job.
Yeah.
He just came up to me and said, before you do that, I need to hire you full time. And at that point, there was no such thing as a full-time instructor. So he's just like, no, you're bringing in too many students. And so, I've always joked that I never had a real job before. And that's kind of true. But sure. That said, as you know from running a school, it's not just teaching, right? So he hired me also to go out and do stuff. So I was on the phone every day calling up elementary schools and rec centers and things about setting up programs and how do I set up demonstrations and things. So it wasn't just the teaching, but the teaching is the thing that most people really want to hear about. So.
Well, actually, you know, I think it's probably useful for people to understand that when it comes to like running a club, there is a huge amount of work is done by the admin staff. Now, in my club, to start with, in my club, it was all pretty much me. But very quickly, my students started stepping up and helping out with all sorts of admin stuff and organizing demonstrations and all the other stuff that goes to running a successful school.
Right.
And it's as well to just flag it up a bit that when you see a successful instructor with a successful school, what you probably don't see are the dozen or so really hardworking students or colleagues or whatever who are actually making that work. Because if you just show up and teach classes, there's nobody there.
Absolutely.
if you haven't advertised the classes, no one knows they exist. I mean, there's so
in the early days, that was me.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I think the first time I met you were at WMAW and you brought with you this gorgeous antique rapier for people to just kind of hold and play with. Right. Which is, It's kind of like, I don't know, owning a classic car and taking it to an event so that other people can drive it around the field, right? So obviously you have like a deep interest in the historical side of things.
Yes,
so,
very much.
So where does your heart lie when it comes to the history?
Oh, where doesn't it lie? It depends on the day. Okay. So I own a number of antiques now, and I've actually started working a little bit with the Oakshott Institute, where they're going to be doing 3D scans of all of them. So I have this beautiful Schiavona that they've recently done 3D scans of. And I think the pandemic slowed things down, but eventually that's going to be online so that people can not only just look at pictures, but can zoom into it and move it around. And they have a number of their own collection there. And so we've been talking about doing things. I have a 16th century Dussac that they might be interested in.
Doing 16th century Dussac.
Yes, it's my wife will probably listen to this, so I won't say it's the love of my life, but
this is a video call. Where is it?
It's upstairs. So sorry. So I have my website, The Hemaists. So that's The Hemaists.com.
Okay.
That website has not been updated in ages. That was a project I started with some students to put up contents before there was a ton of content on the internet. And then all of us got married and kids and things like that. And that site pretty much never gets updated anymore. But there's a ton of photos of that particular sword, as well as the Schiavona on there. So,
oh, lovely. Okay.
Yeah. And later on, I'll get you the link. So,
yeah. Well, I'll be putting links in the show notes. And
sure.
Craig Johnson talks about the Oakshott Institute a little bit in his interview on this podcast. A few weeks.
Yep, I listened to that.
Oh, good. Okay. So I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes as well, so people can kind of orient themselves. So, but I mean, you do work on the treatises themselves, right? Not just
absolutely. Yeah. So my focus has primarily been on the 15th century Lichtenauer related treatises. Mm-hmm. So I dabble in a lot of weapons. I'm a little polyamorous when it comes to fencing treatises.
Yeah, me too.
But my focus tends to be the Lichtenauer stuff. The Messer in particular is my favorite weapon. Even there, I say my favorite weapon. If you put another weapon in my hand, I'll suddenly say, that's my favorite weapon. But Messer tends to be my favorite. I really love all of that full range of weapons, from the longsword to the spear to armor and unarmored and wrestling and dagger and so forth. So that's been my primary material. The Italian rapier would be a very, very close second in the Faber style, and not just Faber's really, it's just all the Italian treatises from that era. So I do a lot of that. But I also dabble in a ton of other things. I do a fair amount of Bolognese. I would never claim to be a true expert at Bolognese swordsmanship. I feel like if I don't have all of the Assaulti memorized, I can't call myself an expert, but I do enough Assaulti. Of it. Yeah. I do enough of it to say that I know what I'm doing with Bolognese.
Okay.
Like with students, I would sometimes do small classes on Bolognese, but I always made a huge disclaimer. I'm like, I am not an expert on this.
Okay. So you tend to go for the earlier stuff. You tend to go for the medieval German stuff.
More often than not. Yes.
Can I'm I also, ask, oh, go ahead. How come you haven't written a book yet?
So I did technically. And that's a silly story. I'll get into it. It's so probably 2008, 2009, I wrote a rapier book. And I'm kind of glad it didn't come out, in the sense that it's so outdated now that it would have just been pointless. But I wrote a training guide to rapier.
Okay.
And to Italian rapier specifically. And did a bunch of photos with two of my students at the time, and there was a professional photographer who volunteered to do all the photography for it. He just thought it was a cool project and he would do it for free as long as I gave him credit. So I put it all together. And at the time, I wasn't sure where I was going to shop around to do it, but it was mostly done. And then I happened to talk with Christian Tobler and Greg Maley, who were like, hey, we're doing this thing called Freelance Academy Press. You should be on this. So I send them all the stuff. And then there were some delays where Greg, unfortunately, had been dealing with family health issues. So that got delayed for a long time. And then when they were ready to go, it's been something like a year and a half later. They're like, okay, now we're ready to look at this. You're going to have to redo these photos or redo these other photos and so on. I'm like, okay. The photographer wasn't available anymore. No. So we have a completely different looking camera. No, none of the fancy lighting or any of that stuff. And it didn't look good. So I send that back and then they're like, oh, now we're going to need to change these other ones to match. And it ended up being this big process.
Yeah.
And that probably would have been something we could have overcome. And then my family ended up having really awful health issues. Both my mother and my father had bad health issues back to back. And that put me out of it for at least another year and a half. I didn't get back to the project. By that point, I gave up because I was like, oh, you know, in the 3 or 4 years since I first wrote this, I need to rewrite the whole thing, right? My understanding of things have completely changed. And I started to, really seriously do it. And another year goes by and I'm like, you know what? I don't think I have the heart for this anymore. Yeah. So that never went anywhere.
Fair enough. That, okay. I have a Rapier book from 2006, which it's
sitting right
it's
there on
my shelf. Oh, bless you. It's dated, but I can stand behind it because it's still everything in it is basically true. I don't really train that way anymore, but it's but my 2004 book, The Swordsman's Companion, when I reissued it recently, I put a thing in the front saying the introduction and stuff about like what is historical martial arts and the kind of all that kind of philosophical stuff, I absolutely stand behind it. The actual technical stuff is totally out of date. So my workaround was I put in a link there so people who've got that book can go to my website and download a free ebook of the Medieval Longsword, which is like the replacement reinterpretation written from scratch. So I kind of got around it that way. But the issue of photography, it's really hard to produce good books with good photos. So I have a workaround for you. If you ever decide to go back to the book, this is what I've been doing for the last couple of years, okay? Because I've got a series of workbooks out called the Rapier Workbooks or something like that. Instead of having photographs, what I've got in the books is I video every action, which is dead easy to do, much easier than taking photographs, right? And I upload that to my Vimeo account edit it and, so basically it's a video clip. And then in the text where you would normally have photographs, there's a link and a QR code so people can point their phone at the page and the video will appear on their phone. So instead of seeing static posed photographs, they're seeing the video clips. And because the link routes through my website, as my interpretation changes or as I get better video equipment and reshoot some stuff or whatever, I can replace the video without having to edit the book.
Fantastic.
Yeah. It's like,
technology blows my mind.
Right. Yeah. But I am not known for being like avant-garde when it comes to tech stuff, anything invented after about 1800, I'm a bit suspicious of, but it's like, it works really, really well. And so if you did decide to go back to your Rapier book and do all that, you don't need to worry about the photos. By all means, take some of those photos if they look nice and put them in for basically decoration, but you can use that same idea. It's important that you have the link that routes through your website, though, so that if, for example, Vimeo goes bust and you lose all of those links, you can just re-upload all the videos somewhere else and adjust the redirect link, rather than having to reissue the book.
Wow.
Yeah.
that's a critic.
Okay. If you decide you're going to do this and you want some help with the tech side of it, just get in touch and I will gladly walk you through the whole thing.
Absolutely. That's amazing.
Put it this way. It is actually so easy that I could do it. but yeah, so it makes producing like a training manual or a technical manual much, much easier.
That's really cool. I'm still blown away by Wichtenauer, to be honest with you.
Yes.
From a technical point of view, the fact that I can go, oh, I need to look that up. Let me pull out my phone instead of, right. Oh, I left the book at home.
Yes, exactly. And there's all, it's not just the treatises. There's all the scholarship going along with it. Tillister is publishing like, the collations of the manuscripts, so you know how the book was bound together, so you know if there's stuff missing. I mean, just,
I love all of that. I've got every publication he's done, and I've actually just last night was just rereading through his 3227A one not because of the treaties, but because of all the stuff about how the choirs are put together and how the book is assembled.
Yeah. And actually, of course, I interviewed Michael for the show a while ago and we had massive technical problems with it, but the episode, I need to re-interview him actually, because you know he's been very, very busily doing an awful lot more very interesting work in the like few months since I last spoke to him. So I mean, if there was a prize to give out for like biggest contribution to historical martial arts over the last decade, I'd probably give it to Michael.
I agree. His work on getting these facsimiles published. I mean,
right.
I am an addict with facsimiles of medieval treatises.
Yes, they're so beautiful.
I cannot believe how cheaply he's doing these. And he's doing it cheaply because he's not making any money.
Right. And he's making these books that you must have the extraordinary edition of 133.
Yes.
I spent like £800 on that book and it was totally, totally worth it. And Michael's doing facsimiles of comparable quality for about a quarter of the price. Now, they don't come with the companion volume necessarily with all the interpretation and translation and transcription and stuff that the Extraordinary Editions does. But actually for one of them, he does have a companion volume, which has similar kind of the modern scholarship stuff attached.
The tall umber one, yes.
That's right, yeah.
And he's doing a new one on Locutioner that'll have that. So.
Right, and he's got the Fiori manuscript coming out. Now, I produced a facsimile of Il Fiore Battaglia about 3 years ago because I publish my own books these days.
Mm-hmm.
I have the mechanism for producing facsimiles for getting books into the print-on-demand infrastructure quite easily, and I wanted a color copy of basically a printout, and I looked at how much it would cost to get my local sort of print shop just to do me a print copy of Fiore, and then I could get it like cone bound or something in the library and there I'd have it. And it was going to cost me so much money, I thought it would be cheaper just to do it through the print on demand thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like half the price. So I thought, why don't I actually do this properly? and I got it laid out properly. And I, put a little kind of bit of notes in the back so that people know where it comes from and what it is. Mm-hmm. Right. And I got both Vadi and Fiore done in the right sizes, but like super cheap. It's literally cheaper. It's literally, you can buy it on Amazon and it is cheaper than getting the color printing done at your local kind of copy shop.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it is. But okay, so at the bottom end of the market, you've got mine, which are cheap enough that you can like toss one in your fencing bag and keep a nice one on your shelf if you want, because they are cheap, right? Because print on demand is relatively cheap, right? But then you've got Michael doing, not only is the printing better, and you can get the gold leaf, like, and all of the crowns and things. But he's even bound it according to the choir structure of the original manuscript. That is like, that is manuscript geek nirvana.
Exactly. Right. And I just cannot believe how cheaply these are being sold. Again, because he's not making any money.
Right. I mean, okay, they're still like $300 or so a copy. Something like that. Which is,
as you know,
insanely cheap. Yeah. For a book that's bound that way, that is insanely cheap. And yet the quality, I mean, I've got the, because I went for the gold leaf on the Fiore, it hasn't arrived yet, but I've
Me
got
too.
The Talhofer and it is, it's immaculate. It's absolutely immaculate.
I'm so excited for the Locutioner one. So
well, I've got that. You know, after he released the Locutioner one, I emailed him and said, Michael, you've got to stop this. Or at least slow down, because I am starting to run out of money. Because of course I have to buy every single one he does.
Yeah.
You know, I have to.
It's just a thing.
It's just exactly.
We have needs, right?
Yeah. And also, you know, we see this kind of work being done. We have to support it. And the thing is, you know, an earthquake could take the Getty Museum away.
Yes.
And there would be the original Getty manuscript gone. Mm-hmm. There's going to be like 100 of these really high level copies, plus everything out on the internet or whatever. I mean, the data is safe. So in 500 years time, there will still be probably copies of this book floating around.
Yeah, it's an amazing thought. And one of the things I was talking with Mike about this, because I was geeking out and thinking, how are you doing this for this price? He said one of his main goals is that as wonderful as the internet has been for the transmission of these treatises into people's hands, he feels that we're getting to a point where newcomers to these arts, it doesn't fully dawn on them that these came from books. And he said, like, of course, there's a logical part of their brain that understands, of course, these came from books, right?
Yeah.
But they've only ever seen screenshots, and not even screenshots. They've only ever seen text that someone typed up on the internet.
Yeah.
They didn't see that this came from a physical object. And because of that, there's also a little bit of a disconnect of what went into these, you know, what are these treatises? Who sat down and actually decided, I'm going to write all of this out? And it is, I hadn't thought of that, is that for, there's a generation of people that they have a little bit of that disconnect where they don't fully understand the transmission of this knowledge. And that's one of the reasons he wanted to do these, is so that people get it in their hands and they start to understand more of what it means to have a book of this.
Yeah.
So.
And, you know, there is no substitute for the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I also say, you know, what Michael's doing, it's the closest you can possibly get to having that original manuscript in your house, right?
Yes.
And, like, you know, I have all the editions of Fabris that have been produced, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course. Right. I've got Tom's translation from whenever it was, and the various versions of that have come out. And basically every time a Fabris book comes out, I've bought it.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
I also have the 1606 original.
Oh, do you? I didn't realize
I have one. Yeah. 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 And it is a fundamentally different experience sitting with the actual book. Right. Now, of course, there were many copies produced. It's not the only copy of There are dozens of them. There must be at least 30 or 40 of them knocking about still, I think.
Tom has a couple. He has a German edition. And I remember getting to leaf through that. You're right.
Yeah.
It is a fundamentally different experience.
Right. So
the thickness of the paper is different, right? The smell of it.
Come to my house and I will put you in an armchair with a glass of wine and I will hand you Fabris and you can
I would be so excited.
You can just bliss out for a little bit and then we can go in the garden and poke each other with swords.
I was lucky enough to go on a trip with Jeffrey Forgang.
Okay.
And we got to go to the Vienna Kunsthistorisches Museum and we got to see the original of the Peter Faulkner Fesch book, as well as the Vienna copy of the Paulus Kahl. And I remember I was shaking. I was like, don't let me touch the book. I'm going to rip a page. Right? We had gloves on and everything, but I was like, I'm really genuinely scared. I'm going to rip a sheet out because I'm shaking so much. I was just so excited.
Yeah, you should be. I mean, it's, you know, for people like us, they are effectively holy relics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now I don't expect non-sword people to understand that, but I guess most of the people listening will get that.
I know enough historians who don't care at all about swords, but who would absolutely understand that.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially if you're working with swords professionally, and it's literally your job. And in our culture, your job is usually part of your identity in a really kind of significant way.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people say, what do you do for a living? But other people say, what are you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a fireman, or I'm a lecturer, or I'm a lorry driver, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's part of our identity. And these books have shaped that. Wow.
Absolutely.
There was a rabbit hole I was not expecting to go down today. That was great. I do have a list of many questions, Bill, and I've got to number two. Okay. Now there is a question that I do want to get to, because I think it's really quite interesting. You taught historical fencing in a sport fencing school.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the great thing about sport fencing, as I see it, is there is a very clear context in which it's supposed to work. If you mm-hmm. won the Olympic gold medal, you definitely did it right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No question. It doesn't matter how you did that. It's by definition right if you come back with mm-hmm. medals. Right. So there's a really clear context of success. And there's also a really clearly developed and defined curriculum of material that is supposed to apply in that context, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a really well-established system for getting people from the kind of the theoretical construct of the syllabus to actually winning medals in tournament,
mm-hmm.
right? So living in that environment, working in that environment, how has that affected how you teach historical fencing?
A lot. In the very early days, there weren't very many established footwork drills, for example, or even handwork drills. So in a lot of cases, I was importing the things that I knew for how to set up a curriculum from sport fencing. You know, how do I start out, even if I'm not teaching the same things, how do I teach a person how to get from point A to point B in terms of movements? How do I teach that person to go forward and backwards? How do I teach that person the not just the physical skills, but also just the mental application? So if two blades bind and one has pressure and the other person has to then disengage to go to the other side, how do I teach them those things? And a lot of that, they were literally just sport fencing drills. They were foil drills applied to a long sword or whatever weapon we were using, because it was already a very established pedagogy of how do you get people just to respond. So in a lot of it, I almost did it just automatically because it's what I was surrounded with. It's what I knew. It's, you know, just teaching a person to do technique A. This is the way to teach them because that's just how we do it. And then on top of that is the physical conditioning. And nowadays, I feel like that has come a very, very long way. Most schools, it's just a thing. You know, okay, yeah, we got a condition. No problem.
Yeah, I'm remembering 20 years ago, the idea of historical fencers doing push-ups was like, I didn't come here to do fucking push-ups. I came here to do swords.
Yeah. Once upon a time, there was a lot more resistance. And
there was.
I hate to say there was resistance to it. Because rightfully, 20 years ago, we had to figure out what was in the treatises.
Yeah.
And rightfully, there was a much bigger focus on just what do these words mean? You know, being in shape, oh, we can worry about that later. Yeah. And so that's why I hate to be hard on it, but let's face it. Once upon a time, it was a bunch of people who were not the most physically gifted trying to figure these things out.
Yep.
And time and place, you know, it is what it is for then. And I think it's worlds apart now. I think most people go to a school, first of all, for better or worse, most people join a school not expecting to read a treatise at all. That's true. They do expect to get in shape. They do expect that, yes, they're going to be doing squats and push-ups and running sprints and doing everything it takes to become more physically able. And some of those people end up having an interest in the treatises themselves. And for better or worse, I think that's the focus nowadays in most schools. But early on, yeah, I definitely was pushing, all right, no, we gotta get up and move. We gotta actually get in shape, because why wouldn't you?
Yes. Yeah. And my sort of approach to the whole, they come to swing swords around, but you've got to make sure they understand it's coming from a book, is I have like facsimiles of the manuscript, whatever system we're practicing that day. Let's say it's a Fiore class. There'll be a copy of Il Fiore d'Italia open on a laptop somewhere, so that people can see this is what we're actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's funny. 20 years ago, the swordsmanship was really a gateway drug to getting people who never move at all to actually start moving.
Yes.
Right. But now it's also a gateway drug for getting people who are naturally kind of jocks and martial artists to actually start studying.
Say that last part again.
People who are sort of jocks and martial artists and, you know, physical types to actually start studying.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah.
So we're like a gateway drug in both directions, which is great. Okay. So, I mean, specifically, I know you've done pretty well in tournaments yourself. And do you see much? Okay, what are the main challenges you would think of when a student says, okay, they're going to go to this tournament, say a rapier tournament, for example? How would you train them for that, given your sport fencing experience?
So I still look at it as a holistic approach. Yes, you can train a person just for tournament fighting. And in fact, so my colleague, David Rao, he was one of my earliest students, and then he was a direct peer of mine and has been teaching at VAF alongside me. He decided he wanted to just do a class he was going to bill it as competitive HEMA.
Okay.
And he said, it's going to be weapon agnostic. All right. No matter what weapon a person wanted to do, he's just going to focus on competitive mentality and so on. But he said his secret was, this is how he was going to trick people into wanting to get involved with the treatises. And when he said that, I'm like, okay, you know,
yeah, I like David.
You know, you do your thing. And it worked. His students not only became incredible tournament fencers, every single one of them, even though they were doing a weapon agnostic class, every single one of them can quote treatises like crazy, because he would bring up modern sports psychology. And he's like, and what we're going to do is let me pull this out. And he'll pull out Docciolini. Or he pull out any other treatise and he starts bringing up, like, see these parts I've highlighted right here? And people would get excited. And he'd be like, you know, you really should read this. And he was doing classes that really, they looked very much like a modern high-level sport fencing class. But he would spend so much time talking about what the treatises said and how that medieval and Renaissance mindset approached a lot of these things. And then he'd talk about, and you got to understand that when we're doing this for a tournament, historically, they were also doing these for these other reasons. And he would bring things up and he would have these things where everyone sit down, he'd talk a little bit about it, because he's been working on his master's on medieval manuscript study. He understands the history so well. And he was essentially tricking people into learning history. And it was brilliant.
That's a man after my own heart. That's brilliant.
So, yeah, it was really, really fantastic. And I forgot what the question is now because I got
Well, the question was basically like, how is your sport fencing background colored the way you train people for tournaments? And I think we've actually we've covered that pretty well. although what I should have asked was how does your training people for tournaments make them into historians? Which is actually but you answered that one already, so as well, so that's fine. Okay. So everyone who does or is in any way involved in the tournament scene has mm-hmm. pretty strong opinions about protective gear.
Mm-hmm.
What are your feelings?
So I'm a big believer in multiple forms of training and all the different aspects of martial arts, mm-hmm. especially historical martial arts. So the protective gear is no different because I believe in the full spectrum of extremes. I, on the one hand, love training with very light gear or no gear, where I love training with sharps, with people who are responsible and who have been around long enough to have control. And on the other extreme, I also believe in just fully kitting up tournament style and going at it because they offer such completely different and important, very vital bits of understanding when I'm wearing very little gear. On the one hand, it helps me to understand the fear of the weapon a little better, yeah. which is vitally important. It helps me to feel the subtle aspects when two blades bind in a way, especially if they're sharp weapons. You feel things that you don't feel with blunt weapons.
Yep.
When I'm doing things with very little gear, I feel there's certain aspects of the art that are completely masked when, well, there's a pun right there, when I put on a mask. When I am wearing more gear, I don't have the same sensitivity and therefore I can't feel things the same way. And I think that's absolutely vitally important. The flip side, I have to pull back, right? I have to hold back to make sure I don't hurt my partner. And there is something to be said of just fully kitting up tournament style where I'm not afraid of hurting my partner, right? Within reason. So that person is going to come swinging for the fences for me and I don't have time to think. I just have to do the move. And so like an example of this was, I remember many years ago, I had met a gentleman who he practiced with Scott Rodell, the Chinese swordsmanship teacher.
Oh, yeah.
And when he was training, he would use his wooden jian and no safety gear at all. So he and I just wanted to just kind of trade notes and we just played around. So we had our wooden swords and it was a lot of fun. And he was really, really, really good. We didn't have any safety gear on. Mm-hmm. So I never went for his head, of course. And he would do a lot of attacking at my shins, which I might void, but I wouldn't countercut. And he was just really, really incredible fencer, but it was something I noticed. So afterwards, I was like, can we try putting on masks? And he's like, I've never done it, but let's give it a shot. And I was constantly hitting him in the head. I'll just swing at you. And sometimes he just didn't react. And certainly when he went for my legs, I was constantly hitting him in the head for that. And at first, he kind of thought, oh, I'm just not used to the mask. But we talked about it afterwards. And he realized because no one ever attacked his head, it had never dawned on him to do it, even though he's technically learned the act, right?
Yeah.
In theory, he knows that.
Yeah.
But his muscle memory wasn't prepared for that.
But I mean, I think that we wear the mask so that people can hit us, so that we can practice against that. So that's why, I mean, I have my beginners wearing masks doing dagger drills in the very beginning, like day one of the beginner's course. So the blow is going actually to the target.
Yes.
Even if it's going very slowly and very gently, it is going to the target.
I feel the exact same way.
Okay.
Hand protection is another one. You know, if I go to an event where all the culture is to wear light gloves, obviously I'm not going to hit somebody hard in the hands. And I know there have been events I've been to where someone keeps sticking their hands out. So I might like lightly tap the hand, just kind of to acknowledge it, that's there. And the first thing they say is, oh, I'm not going to accept that tippy tappy hand sniping. And it's tippy tappy hand sniping because I don't want to break their fingers. And, you know, I don't usually get into it. I don't want to argue. But if I go to a tournament and someone sticks their hands out like that and they're wearing the heavy duty, the lobster style gloves, yeah, right? Yeah, I'm going to hit their hands hard because they're not going to get their fingers broken, but it's there. And it's the type of hit that had we been using sharps, their hand would be gone.
Yeah.
So that's another area where I feel like, you know, that as much as I hate the really super bulky gloves, if we're going to go at it, we're wearing them. So
yeah, I use steel gauntlets for that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I find that really, actually, you know, I've got an article called Spot the Bullshit. Because as I see it, there's in any training environment, there is at least $1 for bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So let's say we've got sharp swords and no equipment. So it's exactly, equipment-wise, it's exactly like two unarmored people trying to murder each other. And so the dollar for bullshit is we're not really trying to hit each other. That's a big mm-hmm. dollar, right? If we're fully kitted up in fencing gear and the swords are blunt, then there's another big dollar for bullshit where mm-hmm. we are basically invulnerable to the sword and the sword is not frightening. That's a big
right. dollar for bullshit.
And well, in sport fencing, there is much less bullshit because the actual, you can actually recreate the environment in which it's supposed to work, right? The actual, you know, a form, like a tournament, it's supposed to work in a tournament. It's not,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have any validity outside. It doesn't
right.
matter what happens outside. So,
right.
so there is like the real, you have like, if you like the real thing at a fencing tournament, if you're a sport fencer, or if you're a kickboxer, if you're in the ring and you're actually like fighting for the championship, that is the environment in which your art is supposed to work.
Right.
As historical fencers, we can't actually create the bullshit-free environment in which our art is supposed to work.
Absolutely.
Because then people would die.
Right? Yeah.
So it's like, to my mind, it's like having lots of different angles of view onto the bullshit-free environment, right? But you just have to be aware of what particular bullshit you've still got for safety yeah. purposes as you come in as you come at it from different directions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I've seen your website, historicalhandcrafts.com, and you make absolutely beautiful scabbards and painted shields and all sorts
you.
Of all sorts of things to make a, should we say, a sword geek's heart happy. So what is the story there? I mean, you've been doing woodwork and leatherwork.
It's actually fairly new.
Okay.
The funny thing is, so I guess when I was a teenager, I was really, really big into art. I was always quite the artist. And that, for some reason, my adult life vanished. Okay. And it took me a while to figure that out because I would feel guilty that I wouldn't ever sit down and draw anymore when it would have been a huge part of my life when I was younger. And I realized swords took up that part of me. Yeah. You know, for a creative type, there's almost like a pressure in your brain that forces you. You have to create, you have to draw, you have to paint, whatever it is to relieve that pressure. You just,
yeah.
in order to survive in life, you have to do this. And that got replaced by swords, by studying swords, by reading treatises, by coming up with teaching curriculums where, you know, that creative aspect
yeah.
got poured out into running a class.
It's very
so, exactly. And so for 20 years or so, I didn't do anything artistic outside of swords. And that used to bother me. And then eventually I just accepted it. And so my son is 4 now. So 4 years ago when he was born, a weird thing happened where I just, obviously, you know, as a parent, you know, you just have no free time all of a sudden.
Yes.
Especially in the early days. Any moment of free time, I either had to sleep or I had to just create something. And I still haven't figured out why this happened. Just something about having a child. I needed to draw. I needed to have something that I was making. And that pressure on my brain again just started coming back in a way it had when I was very young. And that's how I got into leather work. So I had never done leather work before. It's something I always found fascinating, but I just suddenly started just getting pieces of leather out and just grabbing whatever tools I had and just starting trying to tool images. And that's how I started getting into scabbard making, which, you know, I was just doing it for my swords. I was doing it for some friends. And then this pandemic hit. So that's how I started getting into woodworking.
Okay.
I'd never done woodworking before this pandemic.
You're kidding.
Yeah. I also don't have any real tools. I have some planes and chisels. I'm scared to death of power tools. I would die if I use power tools.
Okay.
So I just went on eBay and bought some chisels and some planes, some really old ones that I had to resharpen up and all that sort of thing. Okay. And just watched some YouTube videos and just started making things. So this was all just hobby stuff. I had zero intention of selling anything. But when the pandemic happened, VAF had to close down. So I was unemployed and just decided, hey, this is what I'm going to do with my unemployment time.
Yeah.
And eventually I also realized unemployment meant I need to start finding a way of making money.
Yeah, sure.
So it started out where I was going to make an object here or there and just put it online and say, does anyone want to buy this? And I got so many commissions for things that I haven't been able to do that original plan. And that's okay. That's not a complaint.
That's excellent. No, that's a really good problem to have.
Yeah. So that's what I've been doing the past several months as my job.
Wow. Now, I get the thing about when your kid's being born, things change. Because I used to be a cabinet maker. And that was my job for like 4 years, 5 years after leaving university. And then when I switched to teaching swordsmanship full time, I didn't really do any woodwork at all. And then when my wife was pregnant with our first, I just thought, I just don't want to put the child in behind bars, you know, in a cot. It's like, no, that just doesn't feel right. And so I came up with this design and I produced a wooden cot with a sort of cherry frames with birch ply panels. And with cutouts of like trees and rabbits and, you know, very, very sort of cheerful and kind of kid friendly, but still it's a cot, but they can see out and the air can move through. But it's not bars. It's like a kind of woodland scene sort of thing. Just cut out of plywood. Mm-hmm. And that sort of, I don't know, that switch got turned back on in my brain and I've been doing woodwork off and on ever since. And during the pandemic, I have spent more time probably in my shed, on my workbench than I have done writing books. So I totally get it. Oh, and of course, if you ever get, you know, want any help with the woodwork side of things, just
absolutely, you know, I'll reach out.
Give me a call.
I remember way back in the day on Sword Forum where you had made a lecture. For your books to rest. And I remember you posting on there and be like, hey, I know it's not swords, but it's to put my sword books on. And I just remember like, that is so cool. And so that's been on my mind for 2 decades.
And that's Christian Tober's fault, because it was when his book In Service of the Duke came out and it was so big that I needed something to put it on so that we could actually look at it properly. And I had, because I was doing loads of other woodwork at the time, I had all this stuff kind of in my woodworking shed in Finland. And, you know, I realized I had all the bits I needed to just basically make it up out of spare parts. So I just, that was quite a while ago. That must have been like 2007, something like that.
I guess so. I just remember that stuck in my head. Like, I want one of those. So ever since I've been doing the woodworking, I've been just, in my mind, I'm like, I'm going to make that. I haven't had time yet, but I'm going to make one of those.
Are you familiar with Rex Kruger on YouTube?
Yes. I watch his YouTube channel religiously.
Yeah. I actually support him on Patreon.
Oh yeah.
I have access to his, to the forum and the plans and everything. He's a really, what I really like about it, actually, his approach. He has his Woodwork for Humans series where it's like, you have like these three or four basic cheap tools and using just cheap, crappy wood from the local, I guess you call them big box stores in the States. Mm-hmm. That's not an English expression, but I guess it means like a big.
I've never heard that expression till him, but I understood it when he said it.
Right, okay. And So, make yourself a workbench like this, and you don't need to buy a vise. If you've got the money, go ahead and buy one. But you can get these spare parts from various other things, and you can get a working vise like this. And that approach, that is so exactly how I like to think of swordsmanship, right? If you don't have $1,000 for swords and equipment and stuff, and you don't have another $1,000 for fantasy books and what have you, doesn't matter. You can download free scans. You can download free videos, and there's all these things you can do to get good at the art that you care about without having to put a ton of money in it and without having to have any particular natural talent. You can just do the work and get where you want to go. So it's just really nice, I just really like the attitude. That's why I backed him on Patreon. It was just like, this dude deserves it.
And for me, like I said, I'm scared to death of power tools. So his YouTube series has been phenomenal because it's been, all right, you know what? Here's how we do it. Here's how people used to do it. Here's a little bit of historical context. And this is what you need to do it. And I'm like, perfect. That's me. I don't even live in a place that could fit most of the power tools that most woodworkers use anyway.
Right.
So I don't even think I would have really seriously got into this at all if it wasn't for his YouTube channel. So
yeah, I mean, I do have some friends who got into woodwork, and so they put a gigantic like $2,000 saw stop table saw in their basement, and I was like, well, okay. That's one way to go. I'm very glad you got the money for that kind of investment. Carry on. This is great. And it's like, it's a great thing. And if I had that kind of basement space and I had the money, they bought the saw I would have bought. The power tools are nice, handy. I mean, I have a little bandsaw in my workshop and it's like really, really helpful. It speeds things up enormously. But you really don't need like the big machines because they didn't used to have them and they made amazing furniture.
I feel that if I were in a position where I had to recreate the same object over and over and over again, power tools make more sense for me. But I'm approaching this from a different perspective. I'm creating an object because I like it.
Yeah.
And I don't need the power tools to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, when I was making furniture for a living and doing antiques restoration and what have you, we used power tools for all the donkey work, you know, planing down, you know, getting basically rough sawn planks that are dried out and then, you know, machining them into basic components. But we cut all the joints and things by hand because it's just better. You can just get, the problem with the machine is you have to, again, I guess it's like a too strict curriculum. A really strict curriculum is really good for producing certain results in certain students. But there are some students who just will never fit in that curriculum.
And that's a very good analogy.
Right. I like to cut hand cut dovetails. So for example, my little watch stand here, you can see there's like these little dovetails.
That looks great.
I'll put a picture of that in the show notes. Often when I'm cutting dovetails, I'll do it so that the pin comes to such a narrow point that it is impossible to do that on with a router because there isn't space for the shank of the router to fit through, right? So, and doing it like that, it doesn't add any mechanical strength to the joint. In fact, it's probably a little bit less mechanically strong, but the joint is plenty strong enough anyway. But it's just like, you can't do this with a machine. I can do it with my 2,000-year-old saw technology. It's like, I love that stuff.
I get it. I absolutely
get it. I thought you might. You're an artist. Of course you get it. You've retired from teaching swordsmanship professionally. And you said earlier, and I made a note, which is how I remember to come back to it, There's a difference between teaching professionally and teaching as an amateur, right? And I've done both, and I honestly much prefer the professional thing. It just works better for me. But I'd be interested to hear how you feel the main differences are. Well, what is the difference?
So I'm in a position where I have not done a lot of amateur teaching. So I clearly can speak much more to it from the professional side. I have definitely noticed when I have visited more informal clubs, things like, all right, it's time to start, and people dilly-dally and talk and things like that. That's something that's for me, I'm like, no, the class time started here. This is what we're doing. And there is something to, I suppose on an amateur level, you could set it up where one person's in charge. They say, this is what we're doing, and everyone does it.
Yep.
So there are certain elements that I feel like if I go back into teaching in an amateur way, how will I adjust to me saying, hey, everyone, boom, let's go.
It's club culture.
People don't.
My kids my younger child used to do judo in the club around the corner. And again, all the coaches there, they're not getting paid. So they're amateur coaches. Mm. But the classes run according to, they have a kind of salute thing at the beginning where everybody bows, and then they have their warm-up stuff and everyone does what the coach says. And that isn't an artifact of the coach getting paid. It's just an artifact of the culture of the club.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that by itself isn't too hard to set up. If you're setting it up from scratch, I think if that's the expectation of, then that's what will happen. That's how it goes.
Yeah. So maybe I'm overthinking that. I don't know. Like I said, I'm in a position where I've actually done very little amateur teaching. Mm-hmm. I have almost exclusively done professional teaching. And so I don't entirely know what to expect. And that's assuming I go back into teaching, to be honest with you. And on one hand, for me, it's hard to imagine not teaching because it's been such a part of my identity for so long.
Right.
But I know when this pandemic clears up and when my son's a little older and just family life stabilizes a little more, I already have plans to do other martial arts. I started doing Kali online just to start doing it because I've always wanted to.
Well, great.
And I've never been able to branch out for things because the times that I'm teaching are the times that other people are teaching, right?
Do you know,
my evenings have not been free for 20 years. My weekends have not been free for 20 years. So
I could totally relate to that. In 2016, I retired from teaching full time. In other words, running a club and showing up four nights a week and weekends and what have you. And oh my God. Having my evenings free, it's just, it's heaven. But I still teach for a living because, I've got my online courses and my books and my habit.
Sure,
and I go around, but these days, almost all of my actual in-person teaching is weekend seminars organized by clubs or what have you for me to go to teach at.
Mm-hmm.
So you can still teach professionally without actually doing the day-to-day.
That's
been my experience, and it is so much, particularly with kids, it is so nice to be home in the evenings.
Yeah. That was something that I was kind of dreading when we had our child. So I just have one boy, Finn, and I was dreading that. I'm like, how am I going to handle when he's older in school and he's got after school things and recitals or whatever else he's doing. And so it is a big relief to be okay. I'm going to be home in the evening. That's honestly, there's a lot of hard things to running your own business to begin with. And even though it wasn't my own business, I still was very involved with that.
Yeah.
But I think the hardest part for me with teaching fencing just over all these years was the schedule. Even having a social life is rough, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I've absolutely been there. And I can't imagine not teaching swordsmanship. That would just be a weird state to be in. But I haven't actually taught an in-person class since my last actual live in a cell with students was in Australia in 2019, November 2019, with my last in-person classes until the next one, until everything opens up again. Although I did one in a field near Ipswich because a local club had when we had that kind of brief moment between lockdowns, they had a session, and I just contacted and said, look, I am desperate to get up. Do you have a class? can I please come and teach you for a couple of hours on Saturday morning? They're like, really? And I was like, yeah. And I was like, okay. and you know, the pubs were open then, so they paid me in beer afterwards, and it was absolutely fantastic. But yeah, it's super difficult to have a life if you're always working when everyone else is free. It's just, you know, having the same sort of schedule as everybody else really does help. Friends going to the movies in the evening back when that was a thing. and you can come because you're not teaching. And like you said, there's this fantastic jiu-jitsu club here in Ipswich that when it was open without the lock, you know, outside of Corona times, I would go relatively regularly because they were really, 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 really good. And I could go because I wasn't teaching. but there are ways to, like, teaching online. It's possible. There's some things you can teach and some things you can't teach online, but it's useful. But I'm doing all the talking.
It's because in that area of actually having evenings free and so on, you're more experienced than me now.
Okay.
I'm trying to learn from you.
but I guess the thing is, though, teaching is part of who you are. So you're probably going to find ways to make it happen, even if you're not doing
it. I think you're right. I absolutely think you're right. I've had the entire pandemic to not be teaching, of course, but it's only been a recent thing where I've had to tell VAF, like, look, sorry, whenever things are normal and whenever we reopen, I'm not going to be able to come back. Just family life just won't allow it right now. Okay. So it's only been a recent thing that I've had to grapple with what next. And during the pandemic, it's kind of a moot point, but the pandemic will be over at some future date. And
sure.
I'm still sorting out what I'm going to be doing for that part.
Right. Well, I can recommend online courses. I can recommend writing books, and I can certainly recommend teaching weekend seminars. Because it's great. You get a holiday from the kids, because let's face it, if you're home all day, you need a holiday from the kids every now and then. And oh shit, I'm in trouble now because my wife might listen to this, and I've just, like, confessed that actually me going away to work for the weekend, it does actually feel a bit like a holiday sometimes. Shit. I'm in trouble now. Okay. So we're not sure what's coming next. So, okay. When you figure it out, if you want to come back on the show and tell us, we'll be delighted to hear from you.
Excellent. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now I have a couple of questions that I tend to finish up with. And the first is, what is the best idea you've never acted on?
You know, so you sent me sample questions and I read that one and I racked my brain on that. And I'm like, what is it? And I'm going to say something that I hope doesn't sound like I'm bragging, but I don't have anything like that because my personality isn't quite like that. I don't either. When I have an idea, I go out and do it, or I decide, no, that's just not possible. And I don't really have ideas that I didn't really act on. Now, that said, I failed on a million ideas.
Yeah, sure.
Still do all the time. But I don't really have anything. And I thought about it long and hard. I'm like, no, I tried that. Didn't work out. Or, you know, I did something else. I just couldn't come up with an answer for that.
do you know? Quite a large proportion of my guests are like that, which is not surprising when you think to get to my attention, in other words, so I know who they are well enough to invite them onto the show, they must be acting on stuff.
Yeah. Right?
Because I don't know, although quite a few, they have a book that they wish they would write or the book that they intend to get on with. But no, I get it. It's, honestly, I don't have any either. Because either I acted on it or it wasn't an idea I particularly liked.
Yeah. And I mean, it makes sense that so many people, if you're in kind of an instructor's role or something where it wasn't just, oh, okay, let's get some people together to swing swords. It was literally, all right, I'm going to set up a curriculum. I'm going to set up events. I'm going to set up these things. You kind of have to have that drive of, all right, this things are good. How can they be better?
Right.
And that's tends to be how I operate. How can I make things better? It's, you know, things are fine now, but not, it's not even not good enough. It's just, how do I keep making things better? How do I keep improving?
Sure. Okay. My last question, somebody gives you $1 million or so to spend improving historical martial arts worldwide. How would you spend the money?
So I would absolutely, and we're going to use the word million very loosely because propose would be.
100 times that. Yeah. Okay.
I love the stuff that a lot of museums are doing with 3D imaging. And I mentioned the Oakshott Institute earlier.
Yeah.
I would want to set up some kind of museum / university that is focused on swords and swordsmanship, but largely focused on the physical objects.
Okay.
So we would be setting up essentially a museum where people could come and touch the swords and pick them up. And there would be tours explaining, okay, this is how these swords were used and so forth. There'd be demonstrations from various different instructors, and you put all this stuff not only in a physical building, but also online so that people who couldn't get to it could go online and see the 3D imaging where they can actually go, oh, that's cool. Let me, you know, just touch on my phone and move the sword around so I can see the different angles and so on, which is what many museums are starting to do now.
And maybe make it immersive with like a headset or something that they could go in and actually walk around the museum.
Yeah, that's cool. Exactly what I'm thinking. And then you have, you know, demonstrations from different sword fighters, just explaining how certain treatises were done, where you could actually have treatises that people could access very easily. Just things where people could get more immersive than just photographs or just a sword that's hanging on a wall.
Yeah.
And that would be what I would want to do. Is I know Roberto Gaudi has been doing stuff with his stuff.
It's a museum in Brescia.
Yeah, and I would want to do something like that, but with a major focus on making it accessible to people outside of whatever area you're in, which is hard. So you would fund people to do traveling demonstrations, where you know we're going to travel out to this event purely for the sake of bringing swords and making sure that people get to pick them up.
Yeah.
Obviously for the martial artists out there, but also for schools, for kids to see. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that's hard if you are not in an area where people have actual real swords, right? When I say real, I don't mean reproductions. I mean the actual antiques.
Yeah.
The reason I own antiques at all, well, partially because I just love swords, right? But the reason I have justified the price tag of antique swords is because I want to put them in people's hands. I'm actually right now, I've just bought a 15th century Baumwehr, the little German knives, and it doesn't have any kind of handle on it. So my intent is to make a little clear plastic, the scales, the clear plastic scales, and use wax to hold it on so that people can actually pick it up and feel what it's supposed to feel like.
But it's clearly not, you're not interfering with the historical piece.
Right.
You're doing it as a conservator would, not as a restorer.
Right. Yeah. And that way you can still see the tang because it's clear. And the intent is put it in people's hands so they know, okay, this is what an actual 15th century Baumwehr feels like. And that's always my intent, right? So I want people to be able to pick it up and feel the object. If it's just on a wall, then what's the point, right? I mean, I shouldn't say that because museums are a major inspiration, but...
I mean, again, that's what I really like about the Oakshott Institute is, you know, Craig Johnson has shown up to events with great big boxes full of amazing antique swords and just let people swing them around.
Yeah.
And it changes things.
It does. One of my first experiences with actual medieval and older weapons was Craig bringing it to I think it was the 2005 Western Martial Arts Workshop. And it was exactly as you said, just a big box of weapons. Here's the table. All right, people, here's your gloves, play. And I remember there was a, he had a bronze sword that I feel like was about 2000 BCE.
Yeah, that's right.
That before that time, I'd never had any interest in bronze weapons. And I picked that up.
Oh my God.
And it was magic. Yes. And seeing all the tiny details on it, that gave me a completely new appreciation that I never got from just looking at pictures and books.
So. I know exactly the sword you're referring to. I think when I was chatting to Craig on the show, we talked about the experience of holding that sword. Just... Oh my God. Wow.
So, okay, so I will say the Oakshot Institute was a big big inspiration for me. And so when I saw you had that question, I'm like, oh, that's absolutely what I want to do.
That's a fantastic idea. And just making it easier for people to really get the experience of it. So Well, if I had the money, I'd give it to you. But I say that to pretty much every guest. It's like, you know, there are so many excellent ideas. And a lot of them kind of do center around that idea of having like a center where people can go to actually like experience the thing. Wonderful. Well, Bill, I think that's a great place to finish. Well, thank you very much for talking to me today. It's been a delight.
Well, thank you for having me. This has been great.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Bill Grandy. You can find the episode show notes at guywindsor.net/podcast. While you're there, you can sign up to my mailing list and I'll send you a free copy of my book, Sword Fighting for Writers, Game Designers and Martial Artists. I'd also like to thank my patrons on Patreon for their kind support of the show. It lets me know that you care about the show and want it to continue. And a special thanks this week to new members and new supporters who, as always, have chosen to remain anonymous. I don't know why they do that, but they do. You can join us there for behind-the-scenes content and to submit your questions for future guests. Patreon.com/TheSwordGuy. Join us next week when I'll be talking to Danielle Cybulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist, about medieval history and her medieval podcast show, her medieval masterclass, and pretty much all sorts of other things medieval. So if you're a medievalist, you don't want to miss it. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcast from. And while you're there, please do rate the show. And if you have an extra minute, leave a review. It really does help. I'll see you next week.